Hello and welcome to the M&M Show. I hope everybody's keeping well. And my name's Maisie.
And my name is Simona, also called Mona.
Hello everybody out there. So listen, today we've got someone special. We've got a man who's joined...
A man is always special in my view.
A man is very special, isn't he? So we've got Stephen McCauley, who's a resident, or part-time resident, hypnotherapist, and he's joined Cumbernauld Deaf M on a weekly basis. And so we brought Stephen in to just give us up to speed exactly what he does for everyone out there and what his mission is. Alrighty, so here we go. Welcome, Stephen, to our lovely M&M show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, great to have you here. So we've only just found out you're doing hypnotherapy, but you also do, you've got a lot more strings to your bow. So what is it you've got there?
I am the archetypal jack of all trades.
All right.
But yeah, but no, what I do mainly is hypnotherapy, coaching, stuff like that. But yeah, my background's pharmacy, business.
So are you a pharmacist? Sorry.
No, I'm not a pharmacist. I was actually put off becoming a pharmacist by pharmacists.
I can fully understand this.
Yeah.
I think you can speak on any, you know, science or trade or anything that, you know, the education can put you off, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think pharmacists, it's the way they're sort of viewed, I think, in terms of the way the public view them, almost as though they're a shopkeeper, you know.
Exactly,
and they're highly qualified people, you know. So, yeah, I spoke to a few people. Anyway, I didn't go down that road. So we've still got the pharmacy. So I've went into the business side. I'm the managing director there. It's quite a big pharmacy, family business. But for years and years and years, I've been very interested in coaching because I've got teams of people that I'm working with and to motivate people and all these different things. And I think even since I was a kid, I was always fascinated by the mind and why we do things. I come from a really big family, so I'm the youngest of 12.
Oh, that's the same as myself. Yeah.
What, 12?
Yeah. She's the 11th.
12, I'm number 11.
What? So you're the second youngest?
Yeah.
So I'm the youngest, we're almost...
Yeah, my dad's there.
And my dad was from a family of 12 and he was the youngest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Big families.
So it's funny because we often say, I always say I grew up with five big brothers and five big sisters because my second oldest brother, I didn't meet him. He died when he was an infant, unfortunately.
Because one of my sisters, she died when she was 8 years of age. I never got to meet her either.
Oh, goodness. So yeah. It was originally 13? No, it was...
12 of us, but there's 11, right. 11 now. Yeah.
That's funny. So most people would say I'm number 11 as well.
Yeah.
In the family, for some reason, I don't know why. I think it was just... anyway.
It just happened, yeah.
Yeah, just the way we've kind of tended to refer to it. But yeah, so big family. And I think observing all those big brothers and sisters and having conversations with them, you know, one sister in particular, who again, she's passed away now, unfortunately, but she was fantastic. She taught me all about how women's brains work and all this kind of stuff, you know, from an early age, and how we're different, you know, men and women are, you know, that sort of thing, which was fantastic for me because I think it saved me a lot of figuring stuff out.
Well, we're the same. How do we figure out men? Well, really, there's not much you can say about it, eh?
Yeah.
They're anomaly as well.
Trial and error.
You know that famous book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are
From Venus? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I'm different because I'm definitely from Jupiter.
So I think really just from an early age, being around all these adults who are siblings, you know, and having these conversations, just really got fascinated. So I think I did my first coaching course probably in 2010, although it was coaching before that, you know, just make it up as I go along, because that's what you do in business. But then first coaching course, which was NLP based, neuro-linguistic programming, and then it just evolved from there really, you know, evolved into hypnotherapy and various different modalities. So I think if I was going to describe myself, it would be a transformational coach using hypnotherapy.
Right, oh, that's actually quite a good one, isn't it?
Is there any purpose declared for this transformation?
Purpose?
Yeah, I mean, when you speak about transformation, you go from one place to another. So what would be the place that is the goal for this?
It's not always a place. You know, it could be something like, we were having a bit of fun earlier talking about spider phobia and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So someone can stay in the same place and not be afraid of spiders.
Oh, right.
So sort of transforming how you interact with the world, I suppose. terms of, you know, so you're transforming almost your perception of things.
To be more adapted to life and society.
Absolutely,
and more happy with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, we come into the world with two fears inbuilt. The fear of loud noises, the fear of falling. That's it. Everything else we pick up along the way. So the older we get, the more, you know, peccadilloes we pick up, you know, habits and tendencies and fears and phobias, all these different things, anxieties and stuff like that. So that's, I'm really fascinated in it. And having actually gone through quite a long period of my life suffering with anxiety, I think that's what really prompted me to, you know, do this full time. Basically, you know, so...
All right, so you had a lot of anxiety as you were growing up then?
I wouldn't say when I was growing up. I think I was quite resilient growing up,
right,
just because you can imagine big family and stuff.
So when did that happen? When did you realise
Well, that? I first noticed it, I didn't know what to call it, but I first noticed it in my early 30s. And it just, there was a lot of things happened in life. I'd lost my sister, who I was mentioned earlier. She was 45. And then I was getting married. And it was difficult because we thought about even delaying the wedding because she wasn't going to be there. And I wanted to mention her in the speech. Wow. So I just remember that was a difficult time in life.
Yeah.
And then there was other things happening in the business. A lot of stuff going on. Essentially, a lot of changes happening.
Uh-huh.
And I just think it was a wee bit too much. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up with this thing that, you know, I now refer to as anxiety. Although I must say, I don't like labels. I think once you put the label on yourself, you know, it exacerbates the thing. But yeah, so I noticed this experience that I was having and had to learn about it, you know. Otherwise, I don't know where I would be right now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that went on for about 10 years.
Right, so you're saying you were like in your early 30s when you actually started getting into hypnotherapy?
Oh no, sorry, I thought you were asking about
the anxiety.
But
yes.
when your hypnosis started, when did you actually start?
I'm not good at arithmetic. So 2010 is 22 years ago.
14 years.
14 years ago, I told you I'm rubbish. and I'm now 50. So what age would I be when I started doing courses? I don't know.
It was 36.
I would have been 36, there you go. Right, so 36 is when I started. So yeah, not long after that. Yeah, and now that you've said that, I remember I went down south to do the first course that I ever did, and I remember I was really struggling at that point. I was right sort of in the middle of this, you know, anxious period, if you like, of my life. So yeah, and I found that the stuff I was learning was actually helping me.
That actually helped your anxiety, and now I take it then you're all nice and calm and you've got...
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I can still feel anxious.
So do you practice on yourself then if you find anything that's upsetting you or anything like that?
Absolutely, yeah, every day. Not that I'm particularly predisposed to that now, because I understand what anxiety is. It's really a protective mechanism that's just firing off a bit too much, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I can still feel anxious. That's healthy. You know, if one of my daughters isn't home on time or something, I'm like, where is she?
Yeah, that's a natural anxiousness, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'm not in that sort of stuck in anxiety for no reason zone anymore, you know. So anxiety is a healthy thing. It's a protective thing, but it's just that being stuck in it. So I'm not there, but I've been free of that for about 10 years now or more. But yeah, there's still moments in my life when I actually learned that sometimes there is a good reason to be feeling really anxious, and I've learned to assess it that way and think, right, I'm really not in a good space right now. What's going on?
Right.
Is there something that I need to change? Because sometimes it is just...
So it's like a pre-warning, isn't it? That, as you said...
It can be completely irrational.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, again, if you look at the spider phobia, you look at a little spider in Scotland, there's not many of them can do you any damage, but still we can freak out when we see them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's irrational. I mean, that's the definition of a phobia, which is very similar to anxiety. I mean, the difference between the two really is... It's as though one is analog and one's digital. Like the phobia goes on and off really quickly, whereas the anxiety is more like a dimmer switch or something, you know, it rolls up.
Continuous.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, I'm not in that irrational space anymore where I've got this anxiety stuff for no reason. But sometimes, you know, there could be, I don't know, things going on financially in life where you're thinking, I really need to get that sorted. And it's in there in the background, it's under the surface, and it's bringing up feelings in me. So yeah, an early warning signal, absolutely.
Aye, fascinating. So when you joined the Coming Old FM, was there a purpose to that? Did you find there was something missing out there for people that you decided that would help?
Yeah, well, I think the main purpose is to demystify hypnosis, because hypnosis, hypnotherapy, I see as the most effective modality for helping people transform, you know, if you want to get from one place to another. But often people are quite scared of it, they don't really understand it, they don't understand the history of it, and why we're not using it in medicine, which we should be, as an adjunct to medicine.
Mm-hmm. I think some people probably look at it as if it's a bit of a taboo, as if it's like mental health, they don't want to talk about it. Oh, I'm seeing a hypnotherapist, or, you know, so there's still that kind of grey line to it, isn't it?
There's definitely that element, yeah, and that's a bit of a stigma around mental health, I would say. But also, the hypnosis itself can often be seen as a bit woo-woo, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
Tantamount to a magician or something like that. You
very
know?
True, yeah.
So it's about really about demystifying that and helping people to see it in a different way, because it's such a useful thing. You know, hypnosis is incredible. Mm-hmm. It's such a fast way to make changes in your life, because you really go to a deeper part of the mind where a lot of this stuff's coming up from anyway. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a good shortcut to.
So is the patient, the subject, still in control of their will during this?
Yeah.
As you say, they're just a bit guided by you or the professional, but the control still belongs to them?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because I think that's one of the fears of people, as they have seen the magicians doing this and compelling people to act like animals and stuff, you know, crazy stuff. So people don't want to have another person or another spirit in charge of their...
Yeah, of course, and that's a great observation, because people often ask that question. And my response is, well, actually, when you understand what hypnosis is, it looks a bit like a sleep state, hence the word hypno, the Greek god of sleep, dreams would be hypnos. But actually, in fact, I might as well tell you who named it hypnosis. It was a Scotsman, actually.
Really?
James Bray, the guy from Fife in the 1800s, came up with that name. Before that, it was called mesmerism. After Antoine.
Like magnetism, you know. It was a sort of magnetizing people.
Yeah, so that was Franz Anton Mesmer, who thought it had something to do with magnets. He was doing hypnosis, and he was getting great results, but he thought it was something to do with some ethereal force, which, you know, it wasn't the case. So anyway, James Braid called it hypnosis, but then he wanted to change the name. And this is a good explanation as to what hypnosis actually is. He wanted to change the name from hypnosis to monoideism. 5 years later, but it was too late. The word hypnosis was already out there. It was in most European languages by that time. And so he wanted to change it to monoideism, because really that's what it is. It's a focused state. Not easy to say that. But it's like getting your mind on one idea, monoideism. So it's not as catchy, but it's much better at describing it what it is.
Yeah, I know, that is really interesting, because you're giving us a wee bit of background to how hypnosis came to it.
And it's fascinating, the history of hypnosis. You know, in fact, even so, I work quite a lot in dental practices, and I do talks for dentists. You know, I'll go and do like training days and things like that. In fact, I'm going up to the Royal College of Surgeons tonight in Edinburgh, not to do a talk, but to be present there for questions. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the history of, say, dentistry and medicine alongside the history of hypnosis, it's really quite incredible. So I would encourage people, you know, if you're interested, have a wee look into the history of it. It's amazing.
Oh, definitely. And we have just mentioned there dental as well now. So is there another name that earlier on you were talking about, hypnodental?
Hypnodontics.
Hypnodontics, you're calling it now. Right, okay.
So,
and you're getting good success with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And again, it's a fantastic avenue for demystifying hypnosis, you know, because we're using it in a clinical context. You know, I've got someone who's really terrified of, I mean, like super panicking about going into the dental chair, can just waltz in there without a care in the world.
Well, I did say that's what I'll be coming to you soon, because I've got a few problems I need to get solved.
Yeah, so it's amazing to get the feedback from the dental team and everything as well, because they're like, you know, we dealt with this patient last month and it was it was an absolute fiasco, and now that was so easy, you know, so it's really good.
So that's, you've got a dental practice as well that you've joined?
No, I work with a dental group.
Oh, you work with a dental group,
in conjunction with a dental group who've got a few practices in Edinburgh and one in Falkirk.
So they're just calling you for certain interventions?
Oh no, I work in-house. In fact, that's where I'm heading after here. Before Edinburgh, I'm going to Falkirk.
He's got to go back to work.
yeah. I'm going up to Falkirk, because Falkirk Dental Care, actually, I might as well give them a plug, because they're fantastic in terms of how they view hypnotherapy. The owner, Dr. Atif Bashir, whose father was quite, I think he was the first Asian politician. in Scotland.
I remember that name.
Bashir Ahmed.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, Atif's amazing. He's a trained hypnotherapist himself, and so he really gets it, you know. And they're a forward-thinking practice. So I've actually got an office there. I'm based there, you know, so...
Oh, that's great. That's in Falkirk?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So you're finding now that practices in dentistry, they're starting to really look upon that as like a joint effort now? You think that's...
Yeah, well, that's the hope, you know.
You see more and more going to happen?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's certainly becoming more interesting, more attractive to practice owners, you know, because they want to deliver the best patient care, and particularly with anxious patients, it's not just about that, you know. Mm-hmm. It could be something like bruxism, people grinding their teeth in their sleep. We could be dealing with that, or smoking cessation, if they need to stop before they get certain treatments, and so on. So there's lots of things. But with anxiety, that's really difficult for a practice. You know, it can throw out your schedule. If you've got someone there, it's supposed to be like a 15-minute thing, it turns into an hour. You know, so it's a very stressful thing. So I think that's attracting a lot of practice owners. And plus, of course, they want to give the best possible care for the patients. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And how would that work with, let's say, children in dentistry? You know, kids are really, really feared of dentists, especially if they've not been used to it. So have you ever worked with any children?
Oh, yeah. Kids are half in hypnosis anyway.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. So there's these different brainwave states that we talk about. And right now we're in what you call beta brainwaves. We're having a conversation. It's the conscious mind, right? Mm-hmm. But if you start daydreaming or going into a light trance, you start to go into what's called alpha, which is more the subconscious realm. And kids up to a certain age don't even have a conscious mind. You know, obviously this is a conceptual model, but you know, you've heard of when a child reaches the age of reason, it's about 7 years old. Well, the way that I look at that is that's when the conscious mind starts to form. Then you go into teenage years, become self-conscious and all that stuff. But before 7 years of age, just roughly, you're basically, kids are operating in the subconscious mind in that alpha state. So they're super easy to hypnotise.
Oh, that's great. That's interesting, because, I mean, obviously, I've got a couple of grandkids that are really having difficulty with the dentist.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll need to check on that as well then.
Let's think a bit about this. But,
but we're going to go for a nice wee song.
Wonderful then.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll return to Stephen.
Hi, and welcome back to the M&M Show. And we've still got Stephen here, which is going to give us a wee bit more insight to the hypnotherapy that he's doing. So going to take us back to why, and have you had any successes, or you had any people that's been calling you in, Stephen, on the hypnosis?
Do you mean in terms of...
In terms of the radio show and that?
Show.
Is anybody calling you in and speaking to you about it?
Yeah, well, I've done a few interviews with medical professionals, dental professionals whom I've worked with. And, I think last week it was one of my clients who's great fun, and she's very open about talking about her challenges, she's eating disorders and things like that. So I feel as though someone's listening out there, you know, and that's the idea. It's like for someone to say, that's me, you know, I'm experiencing that thing, and here's a potential solution for it. But even just to know that there is a solution is enough for me, you know. But yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's obviously in its infancy. But as long as it's getting out there, I'm not really measuring any results per se. But I just feel compelled to do it. Mm-hmm. I just think...
Well, that is actually wonderful, because I've never came across another radio station or anything like that that's actually been doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's came on to stations to actually talk about hypnotherapy or anything like that. So this is more or less a groundbreaking phenomenon.
I didn't even think of it that way. So yeah, I'm a trailblazer.
But no, that's great. I definitely trailblazing. But you're saying there was someone that's had an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually helps as well, doing hypnotherapy with the eating?
Yeah, so again, if you strip it back to, so my private practice is called Okay Again, and that's the website. If anyone wants to check it out, okayagain.com. So the whole concept around that is that we are born with these two basic inbuilt fears. And it's funny, because I was speaking to an ophthalmic surgeon who decided to go and fact check me on that.
Yeah.
And he loves getting into the research, and he came back and he said, you know, you're actually right about that, Stephen. So I was quite chuffed. I didn't come up with it, I learned that. So we've got this default state of being okay, you know, and if you look at a little baby, you know, you give a baby like, I don't know, like a plastic bottle to play around with, or a bunch of keys, and as long as they've been fed and they're changed, they're just naturally happy, you know, they just sort of bubble with
joy.
Happiness, joy. And so that's in all of us, all the time. So in terms of mental health, I believe that we've all got an innate mental health. It's just that all this other stuff gets piled on top of it, you know. the phobias, the tendencies, the habits, the fears, the limiting beliefs.
All right, so it's all different layers.
Yeah. It's just like you get these things that we collect as mm-hmm. we go through life, and it sort of pulls us out of alignment. But that default state's always there. You know, and sometimes you just experience it, you know, in a moment, and it's like, wow, wish you feel like this all the time.
So would you say that this technique, you know, the hypnotherapy you're practicing, is bringing people back to this innate state in themselves?
Absolutely.
So they can reach back to this and mm-hmm. somehow establish themselves in this condition, or what's
yeah, that? Yeah. I mean, so what I tend to do, again, back to that, the concept of monoideism, you work on one thing at a time, because the subconscious is only really good at handling one thing at a time. In terms of making a change, you know, generally the subconscious handles millions of bits of information simultaneously, but in terms of making a change, it works best if you're working on one thing. But what can happen is, let's say someone comes to me and got an issue with anxiety, they're experiencing that, and we get that resolved, and I use that word specifically, resolved, because I see anxiety as a solution that the subconscious has created anyway. So it might be that, like, for example, me, having gone through a lot of big changes in my life, I started to experience this protective mechanism, anxiety, saying, right, just restrict yourself, Stephen, pull it in, you know, don't go anywhere. If you try and go out, I'm going to make you feel really bad and stuff, you know. So it is a solution. Didn't seem like that, but it's doing a job. The subconscious is doing its job to keep you safe.
Yeah.
So I use the word resolve. So it's already been solved. We just need to sort of update it a bit, usually. Mm-hmm. So if we do that, right, we work on anxiety, we resolve it, we update the program, if you like, to make it more appropriate for the person in the here and now. What can happen is a bit of a domino effect, where the subconscious starts to, you know, clear out other things. Just an example, there was a woman I was dealing with who, it was dental anxiety, and we did a couple of sessions, she was great, you know, fine, all good. And I bumped into her a few weeks later in the waiting room in the dental practice, and she oh, Stephen, I'm glad I saw you. She wanted to share something with me, that she'd noticed that she'd had a cough for about 2 years, and someone had told her that was a nervous cough, mm-hmm. and that had completely gone. And that was just a byproduct of what we were doing. You know, we weren't working on the cough.
No.
So it's, yeah. And I mean, essentially, yeah, you could just work on all the things that, you know, someone wants to resolve, and what's left is mm-hmm. that default state is there. So yeah, you can certainly get to that place and, of course, maintain that. But as we go through life, as you get experiences, you know, things happen, new protective mechanisms can come up and stuff. But when you understand them, you recognise what's happening, and it doesn't really have as much control over you anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. So are they coming back with a remembrance of what happened, you know, during this healing process, or is just that they are changed?
That's a great question, again, because, you know, not always. We can do a technique called regression,
yeah.
And that can be helpful, right? So let's say someone's afraid of dogs or something like that, and then we actually regress back, because the subconscious records everything perfectly.
Yeah.
And a person could go back to when they were like 3 years old in their memory and realise where that fear began. It could be just going past a gate or something, and a big dog barked. Mm-hmm. And when you realise, well, that's why I've got a fear of dogs, really. That's where it came from. And you look at that with your adult mind,
yeah.
That can be enough to just, you know, you say, well, this is silly now. You rationalise it and you say, this is just not necessary anymore.
So they would remember this experience.
Yes, yeah. Regression isn't a technique I use that often.
Aye.
But I have done, and we've got some amazing results. There was actually a chap I was working with who, I won't mention where he was from, right, but not from the UK. He had a fascinating upbringing, actually. A lot of turmoil, violence, and different things going on in his life. And he remembered things from when he was like 2 or 3 years old.
That's amazing.
And he didn't share it with me at the time, because this is happening internally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not having people voice these things. You know, it's their memory, and it's up to them when they come out of trance whether they want to share that with me. It's not necessary, but sometimes people want to. But this particular chap left really quickly after the session, sat in the car park behind the practice, phoned his mum, said, "Mum, did this happen? Did this happen? Did this happen?" And she confirmed all of it, and he couldn't believe it. You know, it was all in there. And you know, the subconscious doesn't forget, mm-hmm. and it holds on to these protective mechanisms based on those experiences, you know. So yeah,
that is actually interesting.
Yeah, you know, there's these concepts that this branch is using, like the subconscious, you know, Jung, Freud, and so on. But I would say it's the soul, and also from our religious perspective, it's the soul, or it's the spirit in the soul that remembers everything.
Yeah.
So there's the essential entity of the human being, which will continue to live anyway after the separation from the body. And what you have there, it's perfect clearness and awareness that we cannot have with the physical brain.
Yes.
In this condition. So everything that is material is more or less obscuring all this that we really are in our perfection, you know, in our creation. But I do think once the body is not an obstacle anymore, as in these deep states of trance, you can reach, in fact, who you really are, what you really have in yourself.
And you know, I was actually thinking about that this morning, believe it or not. I like to watch debates and things. I don't know if you've ever watched Speaker's Corner on YouTube.
Yes, I have done, yeah.
So I'm quite addicted to that, to be honest, you know. And I was listening to someone talking about the Holy Spirit. So he was a Christian, clearly, and he was explaining it to someone, and I thought, so I'm talking about law of attraction today.
Yeah.
And you could sort of look at, well, that's the Holy Spirit, you know, these frequencies and vibrations.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but long story short, although I haven't figured all that out yet, we do live in a non-physical realm, absolutely.
Yeah.
I believe we live in a spiritual realm as well as this physical realm.
Absolutely.
You know, there's two things going on there, at least two things. I mean, what I'm doing is just trying to get people to a better place here, right? I don't know if anyone's ever going to reach that state of nirvana or whatever you want to, however you want to look at it, whilst they're in the body. But certainly we can get back to a state of, you know, closer to where we were when we were young, not a care in the world sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But of course, we don't want to inoculate ourselves from life. You know, you still got to deal with things. We've still got adult things we need to do.
And as you said before, the subconscious or the soul, you know, by releasing this anxiety and stuff, it's still trying to preserve or to alert the person that something is not good enough or something may happen. So we have to consider this too, that sometimes the fears are not to be shunned by any means, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And precautions for life, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely, because, you know, if that were the case, then you might as well just go to the pharmacy and get some strong medication that makes you not care about anything, but we certainly don't want that.
Exactly.
We want the subconscious to be functioning, doing its job, but it can be a little bit lazy, the subconscious, because it's got so much to do.
Right.
Because we're sitting here right now, how much is going on that we're not aware of at the moment, right? So your tongue's probably touching the back of your teeth right now. You don't notice that until you think about it. But there's so many things going on in the background all the time. Your heart beats regulating itself, your body temperature, all sorts of things. So it's got a lot to do. So when it comes up with one of these protective mechanisms, it's like, well, that's solved. If it isn't broke, don't fix it. And remember, the subconscious is seeing this as a good thing, because, you know, if it's a spider phobia, then right, just steer well clear of those spiders. And if you try and go near it, I'm going to make you panic, you know, and it's working. But it's not necessarily a nice thing to have to experience.
Yeah. So an interesting thing would be if there's any success with addictions, I mean, with heavier addictions, not just the phobia.
Yeah, well, one of the things I deal with routinely is smoking cessation, and that's generally one session.
One session?
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's really amazing.
It's
that's a life saved.
Yeah, listen, it's incredible to me, because you think someone's been smoking for 30 years, because we make the mistake, right, that an addiction is something physical, and it can be, right? Obviously, you can have a physical addiction, but often with things like nicotine addiction, well, nicotine's out of your system after 3 days, 72 hours, and you're clear of it. So now it's psychological. And when it's psychological, it doesn't have roots. It doesn't matter how long it's been there. You know, it's not a physical thing. It's like, you know, we've got to really dig deep to get this out of here. It's literally a change that can happen like that. And I've got, I suppose, maybe a slightly controversial view on things like alcoholism as well.
So have you ever dealt with anyone with alcohol or drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. Not so much, I wouldn't say hard drugs, but things like cannabis addiction, things like that. But yeah, I mean, like with alcoholism, they say that, you know, once when someone's an alcoholic, that you can't drink again, you have to completely teetotal and make the break. But I don't believe that. I think people can go back, and actually I've worked with people who've went back to sociable drinking. When you find the thing that's causing them, because it's not the alcohol that's the problem, there's something prompting that behaviour, you know, and when you deal with that, people can go back to a time before they had an issue with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm a great believer in, like, for example, the last smoking cessation that I did there was quite unusual, because the chap wanted to give up cigarettes but didn't want to stop smoking cannabis, which he likes to do, right? Which is a wee bit tricky, I think, for a lot of hypnotherapists, because it's a case of, no, you need to make the break. Like, I had one lady actually wanted to give up red wine, but not other forms of alcohol. That's just a little bit.
That is a bit silly, isn't it?
I mean, it can be done, but it's tricky.
Yeah.
But for this chap, he wanted to continue. He was honest. You know, I want to continue doing that. I like to go camping, and I like to use cannabis and so on. And I wasn't sure about how it was going to pan out.
You can tell me to put it in his cake.
Well, he is smoking it, but he has ditched the nicotine, sorry, the tobacco element of it. So I don't know how he's doing it, but he's smoking just the cannabis itself. But yeah, so he's continuing to smoke, but not cigarettes. So
That's actually quite strange, isn't it? Because, I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand, doesn't it? You're actually breathing it in. I think it's the action as well sometimes.
It's the action.
I used to be a smoker, and that was what I did, you know. You're talking back over 20, 30 years now or something. And I managed to give up smoking, but I think I did it the way you were explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of broke it down to why I was doing it and what I had more or less said to myself. I think it was more or less like a mental thing I was doing. And I said, you know, I don't need to stop smoking straight away. All I need to do is just don't have that cigarette for 10 minutes. So I would go away and busy myself. And then it would be, you know, I wouldn't feel it for another hour or so. Then I go, oh, that was all right. I can do another 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
So I'll go and do another wee bit of cleaning or tidying or whatever. And before I knew it, I kept doing that 3-4 times through the day. And by night time, I went, wow, I actually managed to give up that full day.
But my Maisie is somebody who can discipline herself and other people around her, children, grandchildren. She's very organized. She's very focused, great firm will.
Yeah.
So people like her can do many changes.
Yeah, and
but
thanks very much for saying that.
But let's think that most people today, especially young people, are totally messed up and confused and disorganized in their thinking and their will.
Yeah.
So I really think they need more support in order to start learning to focus.
So we're thinking more willpower as well.
To get more willpower.
Yeah.
They release all their willpower to the virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it goes.
They're pretty much in a constant state of hypnosis.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That's
yeah, because when you think about it, like some people say, do you think I can go into hypnosis? That's a question I often hear. Like, yeah, well, we're having a conversation, we can understand each other, so yes, you can go into it. And by the way, you've already been in hypnosis. Did you wake up this morning? Yeah, okay, so you went from sleep to wakefulness, so you went through a hypnoidal state where you're half and half, you know, that's hypnosis. Or, you know, if you're reading a book, you get to the bottom of the page and you think, I've got no idea what I just read there, and you need to go and do it again. You've tranced out. But when you see kids on social media, they are in a trance. And it's immersive, as you say, you know, they've got earbuds in and different things going on, and they're in a completely different
reality.
Yeah, different reality. Yeah.
And this to me is the most worrying thing in the world, that they are not sharing this reality with us, especially in these times when things are getting tougher for all of us.
They're
detached, they live in their
but
bubbles.
Then that's up to the parents as well though, because
maybe it's too late for that, because maybe it's too late for that in a way, because everything in their life is about escaping this world.
It's really interesting that you should say that, because sometimes I'll describe what I do is actually de-hypnotizing people.
Right.
And when you think about, you know, advertising, for example, right, what is on radio, what's the number one slot, what's the best slot to have, what's the prime spot on radio?
Well, you're asking us.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably the morning, I would say.
The morning.
Yeah.
Or maybe drive time, or, you know, there's certain times of the day that are really good. So even if you look at drive time, for example, that's a time when you would go in a hypnotic state, you know, when you're driving.
Yeah.
You can get from point A to point B and think,
and you don't remember how I got there.
I do that all the time. Well, you're trancing out, you know.
Yeah.
And that's called highway hypnosis, actually.
Well, I call it automatic pilot.
There you go.
Exactly.
But that's like the sort of the subconscious takes over, because when you're first learning to drive, it's all conscious mind. It's exhausting. You know, you're having to remember everything. But then as you keep doing it, like you did with the cigarettes, actually, a little bit at a time is getting filed back into your subconscious. then it becomes automated, you don't have to think about it anymore. Mm-hmm. But when you're in that subconscious state and there's music on, which is trance inducing as well, then there's an advert, isn't there? There's different adverts coming in and out, you know. So that's a really clever place to put your adverts, you know, when people are a bit tranced out.
Definitely.
It goes into the subconscious, so, and which is fine, you know, that's okay, but there are things that are really not good. Again, in social media for kids, how do you even regulate that? What's going in there? We don't know. And they're in that sort of trance state, and, you know, TikTok brain, as they call it.
Yeah. Plus the gaming, you know, the violent games, and I would call it an obsession, you know, in the old term of obsession, which means a mental health issue, when people cannot deal with the life because they are totally focused on something that is alien to life in reality. So it's causing obsession with these children, and I've seen it.
It's really difficult, and I think, you know, my wife and I, with our kids, we're vigilant, and we do speak with them, and we do work with them, but I see other parents out there who are just so busy with what they've got going on, because the whole world is really confused, and it's getting more and more difficult to just know what to do next, and so the kids, I think, are just, that's fine, they're happy in the corner doing what they're doing. I'll see kids on iPads in buggies. You know, they're looking at something that keeps them quiet, you know. And I understand why parents do that. I'm not criticising them. But I think if you look at it a bit more closely, it's not healthy. And it's utilising a hypnotic state in a negative way. So, it's funny that, because I will say dehypnotising people sometimes, you know.
Would you say once you reach these good results with them, they will stay in this situation for, now, I wouldn't say forever, but, you know, for as long as you know? Or is there sometimes a tendency to revert to their own problems?
Well, I'm not so sure I would use the word revert, but as a protective mechanism comes along, it can do that again for different reasons, right? But what I do is, like old school hypnotherapy, it would be, you go away, you feel okay for a wee while, and then you need to come back for a top-up and different things going on. But I actually do something as standard. Routinely, at the end of a session, I will future pace into someone's dreams, that every time they sleep and every time they dream, all the changes that we've made, all the suggestions that have been accepted by the subconscious, get stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's the final suggestion when someone's in that very suggestible state, so that as they go to sleep, they get another session that night. And then the next night and the next night. And so the subconscious latches onto that. And so it's quite the opposite. You know, when you've resolved something, it tends to resolve even more.
Now that you confess to us that you're a religious person, so you do believe in a God of love and of wisdom, so this is your spiritual protection. So I think this is quite important from my perspective, you know. So would you say that this plays a role, you know, so the people should, not that should, that it's better to be connected to God when they're doing these kinds of techniques, you know, therapies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really venture into religion during the sessions.
Not that you venture, it's in you. So all the good intentions, you know, all the good intentions, all the moral virtues are in you. So we know that because of this, you always aim for the best for that person. It's never about your control or your material interest. It's always their well-being coming first, you know, love for fellow men.
Oh, yes, 100%.
So that's why I said from this perspective.
Ah, okay, yeah.
It's the intentions of the heart that are manifest, you know, in the process of healing.
It's really fulfilling for me, and I think it's, even just looking at this from a secular viewpoint, so I was raised in a business family, right? We've had lots of different businesses. And I understood from an early age that it's not about the fast buck, it's about longevity. You know, it's about staying in business and delivering value, right? So I take that into it. But absolutely, I think with faith, it really does. Yeah, it really does. I mean, I think we're in a spiritual battle, right? This is my personal feeling, right? So we're in a spiritual battle on Earth. And it depends what your worldview is. You can call that something else. You can say good energies, bad energies, you know, positive, negative, or you can say good and evil. And I think that we live in a very fear-based society. And if you want to look at it through the religious lens, you would say, well, that's a tool of the dark side, right? Yeah. And so, yeah, I think I'm moving people away from fear, helping them to understand that there is another way. And yeah, you can look at that through the religious lens, and it just becomes, you know, something much, much bigger. But I do feel as though, I'm doing my part to help people get out of fear. And as that happens, you know, people do tend to live a happier life and, you know, lean towards the good, I think.
Exactly, that's wonderful said, yeah. So I would trust somebody like you to go. I was always a skeptic in matters of hypnotherapy. Mm-hmm. I'm a psychologist myself, you know.
Yeah.
But I would go to somebody like you that I'm certain has the good intentions of the heart.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I would go to somebody I don't know.
Good point.
What mm-hmm. purposes he's serving in. Mm-hmm. You know. But that was really wonderful. And I want to give this news that tomorrow in the town center we'll have another mental health awareness day. In which our Linda from Tony's Safe Place will be involved. So this will happen between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. in the town center, between the Antonine Shopping Center and Clyde Walk. So please join in. Feel free to come.
Oh, definitely, and
Linda's
Linda's Tony's Safe Place. Yeah.
I might be able to manage that tomorrow, actually.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But yeah, so just quickly before we go then, Stephen, because again, we're watching you having to go. And when you're talking about the faith side, I think from what I'm getting from you is because of such a the religious side of it as well, is the Christian side of it, is that maybe that's why you've went into hypnosis, because you want to help people. You've got that compassion, empathy, you know,
If I were to answer that question just off the top of my head, I would say it's because I experienced, I know what it's like, I can see people who are suffering with anxiety in particular, and I'm compelled to help. Now, what that is inside that's compelling me to, I think, is probably something spiritual, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, now that I think about it, it probably is that.
Yeah, definitely compassion for fellow men, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do it. It's not a money-making exercise, you know, obviously we all
need to pay the
bills.
No, but obviously you want to help, because that's what you're saying. If I
won the lottery, I'd still be doing this, you know, I would still be doing it. Because the real reward is, you know, when people say, I haven't felt like this in years. I feel great, you know, after a session. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's great. Word. Well, listen, that was wonderful. Listen, thanks very much, Stephen. I know that we've kind of kept you a wee bit longer than you wanted, but it was really interesting. And I just hope our listeners out there are actually listening and enjoyed what we were talking about today. And, you know, if anybody out there wants to give Stephen a wee call, he's on every Thursday, 11 to 12 on Coming Old FM 106.8. So please, I hope you did enjoy that wee session today. And Simone and I are going to be playing a wee tune. And
I think we're not going to play anything.
Are we not playing number two?
Bye-bye.
Okay, so listen, have a nice day, everyone, and thanks for joining Maisie and Mona and Coming Old FM today.
Thank you.